Good morning, Oregon. Happy Thursday morning to you. This is Finn J.D. John of the Offbeat Oregon History Newspaper Column. This is the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast, and today is Thursday, and consequently, we're doing a reading from an awesome Oregon history book. Specifically, I'm reading the second half of the second chapter of Richard H. Dillon's classic 1961 book, Shanghaiing Days. Dillon's book was copyrighted in 1961 by Coward McCann of New York. The copyright was not renewed, and it passed into the public domain in 1989. The chapter I'm reading from, Chapter 2, is titled Sky Pilots and Pen Pushers. Last Thursday, we talked about the sky pilots. Today, we're going to do the pen pushers. Here we go. Writers as well as Parsons stood by the men of the sea during the mid-19th century. When Richard Henry Dana introduced his classic, 2 years before the mast, with a prefatory note, he declared, quote, "A voice from the forecastle has hardly yet been heard," although a number of works had already directed attention and sympathy towards seamen, such works as Nathaniel Ames' A Mariner's Stretches of 1830, which supplied not only Dana but also Melville with inspiration and perhaps material. Little real knowledge of their hard life had penetrated into the general public's consciousness. Dana intended his book to awaken the public. It was his raison d'être. A footnote here. Author's note. In this reference, the writings of Dana and later those of Melville and Brown, I have abbreviated the original text and in places paraphrased it for the sake of brevity. Back to the text. Quote, "If it should interest the general reader and call more attention to the welfare of seamen or give any information as to their real condition which may serve to raise them in the rank of beings and to promote in any measure their religious and moral improvement and diminish the hardship of their daily life, the end of its publication will be answered." The gentleman of good family was quickly initiated into the realities, as distinguished from the romance, of sea life. When on his very first day on the brig Pilgrim, bound for California, the captain gave them a short speech of welcome. Since it happened to be on the Sabbath, he was milder-mannered than usual. Quote, "Now, my men, we have begun a long voyage. If we get along well together, we shall have a comfortable time. If we don't, we shall have hell afloat. All you've got to do is obey your orders and do your duty like men, and you'll fare well enough. If you don't, you'll fare hard enough, I can tell you." Later in the voyage, when the crew appointed a spokesman to respectfully present their grievances over a shortage of bread to the Lord Paramount of the poop, that worthy really warmed to his subject. Quote, "Well, what do you want? Away with you! Go forward, every one of you! I'll have you all work you up! You don't have enough to do. You've mistaken your man. I'm F.T. all the way from down east. I've been through the mill, ground and bolted, and come out a regular built down east Johnny cake, good when it's hot, but when it's cold, sour and indigestible, and you'll find me so." The captain terminated his poetic bluster with the blunt threat. "If you ain't careful, I'll make a hell of this ship." With the crew properly cowed, things went well enough until the brig was off San Pedro, California, where a phlegmatic middle statesman, but no landlubber, offended the irascible captain by his slow speech and deliberate ways. He was, for all of that, a good sailor and one who always did his share of the work, but the captain did not give a damn. He called him lazy and surly and began to haze him. Dana knew that the man, Sam, would soon be needled enough to give the captain cause to prescribe for him the cruelest form of punishment carried on aboard ship, flogging. There were many who had decried this form of punishment as cruel and inhuman. The Reverend Timothy Dwight Hunt, in an article in The Friend of Honolulu, titled Wants of Seamen, called attention to this hellish holdover from the days of barbarism. Quote, "It is a fact that seamen are not governed like reasonable men. They are ordered about more like slaves than men, and often by those much their inferiors, either in family rank, in morals, or intelligence. Flogging stirs up mutiny, tyranny drives to recklessness, and threats to boldness in transgression. For a trivial offense, which most likely he himself provoked, the offender is lashed to the shrouds and flogged as one would be ashamed to flog his brute. One wonder is that such a degree and amount of misrule has not been more prolific of mutiny." In a masterpiece of understatement, he added, "The sons of the ocean will always be bastards or deformed should they always cower under oaths and stripes. Good rule and a just appreciation of men's rights have long been on the advance, but they have been slow in their march on the ocean." There were those who defended the cruel practices necessary to preserve discipline aboard ship. One such was William L. Jackson, mate of the American whale ship Inez, who claimed that the merchant service attracted only the dregs of manhood. Quote, "I should be very glad to get a whole ship's crew of reasonable men, for it appears to me as if the ends of the earth, not forgetting the Sandwich Islands, has been ransacked for the greatest contrarieties of dispositions and characters to make out a whale ship's company. There is no class that lives anything like so lazy and idle a life." In one respect, Jackson was right. He placed the blame for the plight of seamen ashore right where it belonged, at the feet of the landsman. Declaring that the sailor's pea jacket was an insurmountable barrier between himself and society, Jackson hit the mark when he said, "That is the fault of aloof shore folk, not masters and mates." Herman Melville later added an amen to this charge, asking the American public, "What in your heart do you give that fellow staggering along the dock? Do you not give him a wide berth, shun him, and account him but little above the brutes that perish? Will you throw open your parlors to him, invite him to dinner, or give him a season ticket to your pew in church? No, you will do no such thing, but at a distance you will perhaps subscribe a dollar or two for the building of a hospital to accommodate sailors already broken down, or for distribution of excellent books among tars who cannot read." With this ignorance and suspicion directed toward merchant seamen by an ignorant public, there was no outcry when the knout was used for purposes of discipline. Flogging was still carried on in the United States Navy and was common in both the whaling fleet and aboard the general commercial carriers of the American Merchant Marine. All three major 19th century American writers on sea themes, Richard Henry Dana, J. Ross Brown, and Herman Melville, spoke out strongly against flogging as well as against the all-around barbaric treatment meted out to Yankee seamen in general. But it took years before these voices crying in the wilderness were heard and heeded. In his 2 years Before the Mast, Dana recalled that one day he and his friend, John the Swede, heard a scuffle in the hold. The captain's voice came up.
"You see your condition? Will you ever give me any more of your jaw?"
"I never gave you any, sir," came the half-choked reply.
The two men recognized the speaker as the landsman, Sam.
"That's not what I ask you. Will you ever be impudent to me again?"
"I never have been, sir."
"Answer my question, or I'll make a spread eagle of you. I'll flog you, by God."
"I'm no negro slave," retorted the seaman.
"Then I'll make you one. Seize that man up, mister." The command went to the mate. "Seize him up. Make a spread eagle of him. I'll teach you all who is master aboard." Sam made no resistance, but John the Swede made the mistake of asking the captain respectfully, "What are you going to flog that man for, sir?" The captain turned on the Scandinavian, livid, ordered the steward to bring up irons, and had his second mate, Russell, iron John. "Let me alone," said the Swede. "I'm willing to be put in irons. You need not use any force." In the meantime, Sam was seized up in the shrouds. The captain began lashing him with a bite of rope on the bare back, using all his strength. 6 times he struck and then shouted, "Will you ever give me any more of your jaw?" 3 more lashes brought muttered words from Sam's lips, and the furious captain rained more blows on him that then had him cut down. "Now for you," he said to the Swede, taking the irons off him. John ducked aside and ran to the forecastle. When the third officer grappled with him, John threw him aside. The captain on the quarter-deck, his face red as blood, swung his rope and called to 3 officers, "Drag him aft! Lay hold of him! I'll sweeten him!" The Swedish sailor was soon seized up, but he asked the captain, "Have I ever refused my duty, sir? Have you ever known me to hang back or be insolent or not to know my work?" "No, but it is not for that I flog you. I flog you for your interference, for asking questions." "Can't a man ask a question here without being flogged?" "No," roared the captain, "nobody shall open his mouth aboard this vessel but myself." He began beating the seaman with all the power of his muscles and was soon beside himself with sadistic pleasure. "If you want to know what I flog you for, I'll tell you. It's because I like to do it. Because I like to do it. It suits me. That's what I do it for." "Oh, Jesus Christ! Oh, Jesus Christ!" moaned the Scandinavian. "Don't call on Jesus Christ!" shouted the captain. "He can't help you! Call on Captain T! He's the man! He can help you! Jesus Christ can't help you now!" While the Swede writhed in the shrouds, the captain paced the deck and addressed the crew. "You see your condition. You see where I've got you all. You know what to expect. You've been mistaken in me. You didn't know what I was. Now you know what I am. I'll make you toe the mark, every soul of you, or I'll flog you all, fore and aft, from the boy up. You've got a driver over you. Yes, a slave driver."
After being cut down, the Swede asked the steward for salve for his stripes, but the captain overheard his request and refused him any medication, and instead ordered him to an oar of the boat which was to take him ashore. Dana was disgusted and almost physically sick at this display of brutality. One wonders what the Spanish Californians thought of this display of Yankee civilization. Flogging was not common on the high drogers plying the California coast. As Dana put it, spread eagles were a new kind of bird in California. Later, the captain decided to ride down the one-time second mate he had broken to an AB, able-bodied seaman, that is. When the latter was flogged, he jumped ship at San Diego. Dana's pal, Tom Harris, told him of other brutal captains. One of them had never been known to hand anything to a sailor. He would put it on the deck and kick it to him. Another had killed a Boston lad by keeping him hard at work while ill of coast fever off Sumatra, forcing him to sleep in the hot, close steerage. Dana was happy to see the last of the Pilgrim and her sadistic master, however typical he might be of the driving captains of the day. Dana, like the sky pilots, was in favor of temperance ships, but he realized that this was not the sole answer to the uplifting of the seaman's lot. He also knew that usually when rum was taken away from a crew, nothing else was substituted by penny-pinching masters and owners, neither coffee, chocolate, or even the water bewitched and tea grudged, as they termed the thin swill issued them as tea. It is regrettable that once on land, Dana speedily doffed his pea jacket to put on the frock coat of a gentleman. His view of his one-time forecastle companions reverted toward that of any other upper-class landsman. While he loathed flogging, he confessed after a time ashore,
"Yet, when the proposition is made to abolish it entirely and at once, to prohibit the captain from ever, under any circumstances, inflicting corporal punishment, I am obliged to pause, and I must say, to doubt exceedingly the expediency of making any positive enactment which shall have that effect."
Dana tried to justify this retreat by declaring that as seamen improved, punishment would become less necessary, and at the same time the character of officers would be raised and punishment would tend to become disreputable, a barbarity, and would disappear. There would be no need to prohibit in all cases and degrees by positive enactment. It is obvious that Richard Henry Dana had a considerable talent for wishful thinking. The second major writer to support American seamen against the abuses of the life in which they found themselves was John Ross Brown, one of the most popular travel writers of the Victorian period in America, and the forerunner of the brand of frontier humor which Mark Twain later personified. J. Ross Brown was never to retreat from his position of defensive American seamen as Dana did, but he was guilty of over-optimism in 1846, when in the very first lines of his book, Etchings of a Whaling Cruise, he stated that, quote,
"Within a few years past, the condition of our merchant seamen has excited very general interest. It is gratifying to perceive that the efforts made in their behalf by the humane and the liberal have been productive of the happiest results. Facilities for their moral and intellectual development are now within their reach. Attention is paid to their comfort. The difference between oppression and discipline is beginning to be observed, and cases of insubordination and mutiny will soon be of comparatively rare occurrence."
Brown was indeed premature. Half a century later, the Red Record would be calling the attention of the world to the continuing brutalization of seamen, all but unchanged since medieval times. Actually, what Brown was doing was to make as vivid a contrast as possible between the lot of the merchant seaman and the whaler, in order to win some regard for the human rights of the latter, and to bring an end to what he called the cruel and oppressive abuses of the whale fishery. He blamed the crimes of the whale fishery, mutiny and murder, on oppression, blaming masters not only for the positive acts of corporal cruelty, but for, quote,
"morally degrading those under their command."
J. Ross Brown bore all of his life the reputation of an accurate and sincere reporter. His words were widely read, but like Dana's, they had little lasting effect. He exposed the cupidity of owners and the tyranny of masters equally, proclaiming, quote,
"If there be any who feel disposed to abuse me for exposing the wrongs of seamen, they may rest assured that I prefer their censure to their praise."
Brown was every bit as warm a friend to American sailors as Richard Henry Dana, whom he praised for his, quote,
"noble exertions on behalf of the suffering mariner."
In 1842, J. Ross Brown sailed to the Indian Ocean as a seaman on the whaling bark Bruce of Fairhaven, Massachusetts. When he returned, he penned his Etchings of a Whaling Cruise to show the world what kind of captain Silas P. Alden was. Brown either could not bring himself to name the man he considered a sneaking brute, or else he feared legal or other retaliation. In any case, he rendered the master of the bark as Captain A throughout the book. Brown also disguised the identity of the Bruce, while at the same time making crystal clear his opinion of her by calling her the Styx. Alden considered his crew to be slaves of the lowest caste and started right out to treat them as such. He would stalk the quarterdeck, exuding pomp and circumstance in Brown's critical eyes, daring the bastard crew of Portuguese and Irish and Americans to look crookedly at him. He would bellow,
"I allow no fighting aboard this ship. If there's any fighting to be done, I want a hand in it. Any of you that I catch at it'll have to fight me. I'll have no swearing either. I don't want to hear nobody swear. It's a bad practice, an infernal bad one. It breeds ill will and don't do no kind of good. If I catch any one of you at it, damn it, I'll flog him, that's all."
When a boy from Fall River, shipped as steward, fell so seasick that he could not do duty, the captain sent the mate to go forward to get a substitute. The mate picked a hand from Charleston, South Carolina, named Smith. The latter refused to act as steward, stating that he'd shipped as an ordinary seaman and would remain before the mast. He was very ill at the time, so the first mate did not resort to force. However, the captain came forward to the scuttle and told him to turn out. Quote,
"I'm sick. I'll not go on deck." "Won't you? I'll soon make you," was the captain's answer. "I'll see whether you will or not."
He sprang down the ladder, grabbed Smith by the shirt collar, and dragged him up from his berth.
"Up with you now, and not another word from you." "No, sir, I'll not go on deck."
The man's southern temperament, despite his lowly shipboard station, began to show himself.
"You better mind how you handle me. I'm a Charleston man myself. Let me go, sir, let me go." "Are you, hey?"
snarled Captain Alden.
"A Charleston man? I'll let you know what I am. I'll let you know that I am the captain of this ship."
He then hauled the seaman up the ladder by brute force and threw him against the foremast. Now faint and haggard with weakness, the Carolinian pleaded,
"Don't choke me, Captain, don't choke me." "Yes, I'll choke the stubbornness out of you, and I'll choke obedience into you," he thundered, shaking him by the throat as a terrier does a rat. "Great God, you'll kill me."
The man, black in the face, was gasping.
"Do your duty, then." "I will, sir, I will. Don't kill me." "Go aft, then, and act as steward till I think it proper to get one in your place. And remember, if you show any more of your stubbornness, I'll flog it out of you with a rope's end."
From that day forward, recalled Brown, he was the officer's dog. Shortly thereafter, W., one of Brown's best friends in the crew, had a convulsion. He was suffering from seasickness badly, but the captain made him stand watch for 2 hours a day at the masthead until he had a sunstroke. For 52 days thereafter, he lay in his bunk, nursed by J. Ross Brown as best the latter could, with nothing but hard biscuit. The captain stated that W. could die in the forecastle for all he cared. Another time, when the helmsman, a green hand, failed to repeat the captain's order to luff in addition to actually putting the wheel over, the captain ranted at him, struck him repeatedly in the face till the lad clung to the wheel to keep from falling to the deck. After calling him a sheephead, a scoundrel, and a liar, he left him. And Brown wrote bitterly,
"Until masters are taught by the severest punishment that their little brief authority does not justify them in acts of tyranny and cruelty, poor Jack must quietly submit to all his woes."
When an Englishman, Jack Smith, and another seaman named Bully Blair had a fight, the captain proved he was as good as his word. He lashed their wrists to the ratlines, and with a tarred piece of ratline gave them a good flogging, crying out,
"Do you feel it? I'll show you how to fight, and your back has been itching for a flogging."
Near the Comoro Islands, the savage humor of the captain was again displayed. A raw young Portuguese lad from the Western Islands, the Azores, was at the ship's wheel in a rough sea, and he could not keep the head of the ship into the wind.
"Steady,"
growled the captain.
"Can no keep her steady,"
answered the Portuguese boy, Frank.
"Steady, blast you,"
thundered Captain Alden.
"She no stay steady."
The captain struck him several times on the head. The poor lad, ignorant of any wrongdoing, could only hang his head down to try and avoid the blows.
"You dumb animal, didn't I tell you to keep put your wheel down? Answer me, I say. None of your whining. I'll flog the senses into you if you don't understand me. That scuttlebutt knows more than you do. You're worse a devilish sight than the old sow. Won't you speak, won't you?"
"No savvy, sir,"
was all the terrified Frank could say. He knew but a dozen words of English.
"You no savvy, huh? I'll make you savvy, you blasted twopence head. I'll see that you understand me when I speak to you.
the captain beat the lad across the face with a heavy rope with all his might 5 or 6 times. Temporarily blinded, Frank staggered back, crying,
"Oh, Capitano, me no savvy. Oh, Christ, you kill me. What for you strike me?"
"I'll make you savvy. You've been aboard long enough to learn English. If you don't learn it, it's your own fault. I'll hammer it into you. Now you know why you're flogged, don't you? Answer me, speak, blast you. Say something, you dumb beast. Grunt if you be a hog. Grunt, I say."
Writhing with pain, the boy still suppressed his cries of agony. This further infuriated the savage captain, who shook him by the hair and raged, foaming at the mouth.
"Why don't you answer? Have you no tongue? Are you speechless? If you can't speak, I'll tell you to grunt. Won't you do it? Grunt, you infernal blockhead. Grunt, you stupid ass. Bray if you can't grunt. Bray or I'll make a zebra of you. I'll stripe your back. You shall make some kind of noise, I swear."
Just then, the husky boat steerer, Antonio, interfered. The captain knew that he had a violent temper and could stir the Portuguese of the crew to mutiny if he wished. Thereupon, the cowardly captain backed water rapidly, trying to turn his sadism into a joke.
"Frank all the same as scuttlebutt, Antonio. He no got plenty of sense, all the same as hog. Hog can grunt, Frank no can grunt."
But no one laughed. The entire crew was on the verge of mutiny when the Bruce reached Zanzibar, and there Brown persuaded the captain to let him leave the ship, his place being taken by a South Carolina man temporarily on the beach. The young writer traveler then explored Zanzibar with only a sea chest of old clothes and $10 to his name. He found it romantic enough, but became very disillusioned by the island's misery and squalor. If the lot of whalemen was hard aboard ship, it was infinitely worse on Zanzibar. Shipwrecked or distressed seamen were either ignored and left to starve or were thrown into the filthy, stinking old Portuguese fort, built 300 years before, which served as a prison for mariners. Brown was horrified by what he saw. Quote,
"I have seen so much barbarity toward the sick here, so brutal a disregard for human life, such selfishness and cupidity that my blood runs cold to think of this number of valuable lives that have been willfully and purposefully sacrificed to avoid trouble and expense. Great God, are such evils to be countenanced by American freemen? Must men who from choice or necessity follow seafaring for a livelihood, who minister to all our luxuries and comforts at home by their daring intrepidity, be treated like dumb brutes? Must a poor sailor who has had the misfortune to be cast ashore be browbeat, scorned, and neglected when sickness and destitution come upon him, and for no other reason than because he is a sailor who cannot make direct return for the trouble and expense? Americans, will you suffer this? I have pointed out the evil. Apply the remedy."
Well, back on shore, Brown, unlike Dana, did not retreat an inch from his position. He denounced flogging particularly, saying,
"It is a disgrace to the American flag that the barbarous system of flogging now permitted in our vessels has not long since been abolished."
He attacked arrogant, despotic, and cruel masters. He took on the public and the country itself in no uncertain terms. Quote,
"The condition of this oppressed class is a reproach to our country, a disgrace to the civilization of the age in which we live."
J. Ross Brown went on to become one of the most widely read authors in America, with many books and articles in Harper's Magazine to his credit. Unfortunately for America's seamen, his interest turned to the new western frontier, and it is with California and Nevada that Brown is remembered, rather than in connection with the high seas or as a masterful travel writer. He was an extremely honest and talented reporter. Had he continued his close interest in whaling or seafaring in general, he might have been of great help in the battle to better seamen's situation. The greatest writer of the triumvirate was Herman Melville, author of the American classic Moby Dick. Melville had a rather varied sea career before turning to the writing of Omoo, Typee, Redburn, White Jacket, and Moby Dick. He sailed in 1839 as a ship's boy on the St. Lawrence, Captain Oliver P. Brown, from New York. Brown was no brute, apparently, and Melville gives us more information on Liverpool than on the forecastle of the St. Lawrence, except to stress how often burgoo, oatmeal mush, turned up on the menu. Since fires were prohibited on board ships at dock, all American sailors had to eat ashore. Melville slept in the forecastle but boarded at the Baltimore Clipper, a boarding house run by a Yank ex-sailor and his English wife, Handsome Mary. Melville got a good look at Paradise Street, Liverpool's Embarcadero, and other booble alleys, as he called the boarding house streets of squalid Liverpool. In 1842, Melville sailed on the whale ship Acushnet, which he called the Dolly in his book Typee, to the South Seas. Fed up with the quarrelsome Captain Pease, whose irritability caused both his first and third mates to quit the vessel, Melville jumped ship at Niku Hiva and fled inland. His fine book Omu tells the story of his adventures with a fictionalized glaze. Melville was not too specific in Omu about the abuses of the Acushnet, but it is likely that it was not so much the attractions of the Vahines of the Marquesas as much as it was being fed up with the violence and arbitrariness of Pease, whose, quote,
prompt reply to all complaints and remonstrances was the butt end of a handspike.
After escaping from the natives of Niku Hiva to an Australian whaler, the Lucy Ann, whose captain was incompetent and whose mate was alcoholic, Melville deserted at Tahiti, was confined to the stocks briefly in Papeete, but then got to Hawaii. In Honolulu, August 17, 1843, he enlisted as an ordinary seaman in the United States Navy, sailing for home on the USS United States. In terms of social conscience, rather than literature, it must be said that Melville's hitch in the Navy made a more lasting impression than his experiences on whalers or commercial craft. He was hardly aboard the United States when all hands were turned to witness punishment. Two men were tied by their ankles to a grating on deck and by their wrists to the hammock nettings. One was guilty of striking a sentry while on duty, and the other had been caught smuggling liquor aboard. The bosun opened a green baize bag and took out a cat of nine tails, and at a signal from the captain, a bosun's mate laid a dozen strokes on the first victim's back. 108 bloody welts were raised on the victim. With a fresh cat and another mate, the operation was repeated on the second man. With lighter whips, or kittens, two little apprentices were next flogged for fighting and using abusive language. Herman Melville was to witness the punishment of 163 seamen and apprentices aboard the United States during his service, but he never became hardened to it, nor did he ever forget it. It has been said that it was Melville's influence which led to the belated abolition of flogging in the U.S. Navy. When Melville wrote White Jacket, drawing on his own naval experiences, he attacked the age-old institution of flogging. A copy of the book was placed on the desk of every United States senator to influence him to vote the brutal form of punishment out of existence in the U.S. Navy, and in 1850, flogging was abolished. Like Dana and J. Ross Brown, Herman Melville tried to awaken an apathetic public to an interest in and sympathy towards seafaring men. There is no doubt that Melville was sincere in his sentiments, but he may have borrowed somewhat from George Little, whose book Life on the Ocean was briefly popular. Little, as early as 1843, had complained, quote,
"Who goes on board of a vessel when she first arrives and takes the poor sailor by the hand? And when on shore, who is it that will introduce him into society and give him a place at the social board or around the domestic fireside? Suppose that a sailor could get from under the clutches of his landlord long enough to keep sober 24 hours, let him enter one of our large and fashionable churches, and how many pew doors do you suppose would be thrown open for his reception?"
It was Melville who, in Redburn, preserved in literature the story which pops up whenever a couple of sailormen start jawing, the matter of the crimped corpse. It is altogether likely that in San Francisco and other ports, crimps more than once put over on a ship's captain by shanghaiing aboard a dead man, but Melville in his book is not content with this macabre situation, but throws in a case of animal combustion for good measure. The result is some of the most terrifying and graphic writing which Melville ever did, a sort of tour de force of horror realism. When the Highlander sailed from Liverpool, a one-eyed crimp rushed aboard from Prince's Dock to carry an apparently drunken sailor, sallow of face, aboard. He was down on the ship's papers as Miguel Saavedra. When the crew began to notice a horrible smell in the forecastle, they put it down to a dead rat, but one of the men found out that the real source of the smell was Miguel, dead, and for some time, in his bunk where the crimp had put him. Another sailor brought a light close to the man's face and said, "No, he's not dead," and suddenly a greenish flame like a forked tongue darted out from between his lips. Within a moment, the cadaverous face was crawled over with worm-like flames. The crew was terrified as the corpse was covered with spires and sparkles of flame, and the man's tattoo burned white so the men could read his name, Miguel Saavedra, against a background of flickering blue before they pitched the body into the ocean, where it left a coruscating wake as it sank.
Melville brought America great sea literature and was instrumental in the abolition of flogging. But in terms of the betterment of the day-to-day shipboard or dockside life of the American tar, he was of no more help than either Richard Dana or John Ross Brown. America's seamen would learn that God helps those who help themselves. No one was going to rescue them. They would have to do the job themselves. The business agent of the Atlantic Coast Seamen's Union, James H. Williams, who took pen in hand to fight for a square deal for seamen, writing many illuminating articles in the Independent magazine, realized this. He wrote, quote,
"Sailors, as a rule, are prejudiced against sky pilots and devil dodgers. A sky pilot is all right in a pulpit, but it takes a laborer to run a trade union."
Well, that brings us to the end of our reading for today. This is the second half of Chapter 2 of Richard H. Dillon's 1961 classic, Shanghaiing Days. We'll continue reading from this book from Thursday to Thursday. Once again, you've been listening to the Offbeat Oregon History Podcast, a public history resource for the state we love, coming to you every Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, relating to offbeatoregon.com. I'm Finn J.D. John. Don't be a stranger. I'm at finn@offbeatoregon.com, or if you want to catch me on Twitter, @offbeatoregon. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Thanks again for loading me down and queuing me up. And now, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.